The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
There is not enough data related to cash, and digital provides data, system-wide corralling, and ultimately, I think digital provides control. So I'd love to talk this over with Ms. Lagarde, because perhaps her intentions are different. Again, I think it's how the political system would use such a move, in my mind, in the final analysis, which would be dystopian.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. I look forward to this every year. I'm just amazed, Dave, when we ask our listeners for questions for the annual question and answer couple of shows, they've gotten better and better and better. I mean, we're moving into the 11th year, and I'll tell you what, some of these questions, it's humbling to just be around the people who are asking some of these things.
It's really fun engaging in this way. And, you know, we have the opportunity to have a conversation, the two of us, every week. And, you know, that gets broadcasted to an audience that we don't necessarily know. They get to know us in some respects. And I know when I published The Intentional Legacy a year or so ago, that again was kind of a, other people know us perhaps better than we know them.
Yeah.
But getting through the questions, it's really wonderful to see the minds and the hearts and the interaction and the concerns and where people are at with ideas and social trends. And so for us, part of the Q&A, what makes it so rewarding is getting an insight into who our listeners are. And we thank you for joining us this year again.
Well, the questions cover the gamut. There are questions here that probably everyone needs to hear the answers to. And then there's others that are a little bit more probing that get into economic theory. And so why don't we jump right in? This question, starting out, a listener just said, regarding your new vaulted service, it seems like one of the ideas is that it makes it easier to move money in and out of gold on a regular basis. However, if you were to buy gold and sell it later and make a profit, I'm guessing Uncle Sam is going to want to cut. Am I mistaken? If not, does the service help you keep track of your cost basis? If you were to be buying and selling gold on a regular basis, keeping track of the cost basis could get hairy really quick. Dave, answer that question. It's a straightforward question, but the answer is yes. When you make money on gold or anything, you owe taxes.
That's right. So the 1099s are the forms that get sent out at the end of the year for each sell transaction, and that happens at the end of the year. But at any point during the year, if you go to your user login and look at the activity, it'll provide your realized gains and losses on each trade. We've chosen LIFO, last in, first out, as a methodology. But again, with the numbers that you have from the 1099, whatever methodology you and your accountant agree to, whether it's average cost or FIFO or LIFO, you have the data to determine how to do that and choose the methodology appropriate for you.
Well, and Dave, I'll just mention, when I use Vaulted, I really am not moving in and out all the time. I'm moving in and out. It might happen once or twice a year, but it's not that rapid. All right, moving on to the next question. Hi, guys. My holdings in terms of metals is about 50% in gold, 50% in silver. With the gold and silver ratio at a 25-year high, I think it's like 83, 84 to 1 right now, Dave, what would you consider as far as trading some of your gold for silver? Any thoughts or inputs would be appreciated. Love your show. JD asks the question, should he, 50-50, should he be moving more gold into silver?
It's a great question. My response would be no. From a gain standpoint, it does have logic. And in fact, doing that may prove more profitable. But remember that gold is the metal for all seasons. And I think favoring industrial metals, if you're talking about the white metals, I include silver and platinum and palladium over gold. What that does is it puts you at risk in the event of a systemic or global economic recession or depression. Again, the industrial nature has a demand reliance and vulnerability there in a real severe economic downturn. So coming back to the asset preservation aspect, that goes by the wayside when you're moving the balance to the white metals instead. So, I mean, this is a really a personal question. If you are comfortable compromising that aspect of security or asset preservation for the possibility of gains, and you're willing to allow the ratios to play out over time, great, that's your prerogative. I just want to keep in focus one of the primary reasons to own metals is asset preservation, and to some degree, you're giving on that by overemphasizing the white metals. So again, the ratios, I think, ultimately will be additive. And there's sound logic here. It's a great observation. But you have to remember that endurance and patience are not easy. And if a market moves against you, you know, you said, Kevin, 83, 84 to 1. We've seen that ratio as high as 100 to 1. Mm-hmm. I like the 50-50 as sort of a max allocation and would probably be slightly under that in terms of a silver allocation if I was making room for the platinum group metals in the portfolio, still with 50% in gold.
Yeah, Dave, I'll just add to that, too. You know, if your dad were answering that same question, he'd say 100% in gold, and then I'm just done. Yeah, he's very conservative that way. And I'm more conservative toward, you know, maybe three quarters gold. But I think age also plays into this. You know, if you're a little bit older and you're really looking mainly for security, there's virtually nothing more secure than gold. Now, going on to the next question, would you consider a few videos on selling or exit plans? Now, Dave, this is where you're unique in the industry. When people are buying from us, the first thing you're talking about is, let's talk about your exit plan. So this question is very appropriate. The question is, just for example, if you had purchased, $20 an ounce, some silver, American Silver Eagles, Maples, Libertads, generic rounds, 90% silver, 5-ounce, 10-ounce bars, what have you. So if spot prices rise $25, $30, $35 an ounce, what would you sell first? Okay. And if you do sell some, what would you do with the dollars? I'm guessing buy more certain coins. Would you go silver to silver? You can talk about this, okay. Dave.
Well, I think I'd reframe the question a little bit. And like we alluded to in the last question, ratios do matter. Mm. Ratios are very important. And I think premiums do as well. So premiums on a variety of products. The ratios and premiums are often more important than the price, that is the nominal value of gold or silver. So in a mixed up world where the prices of assets are subject to monetary policy driven inflation, I think it's very important to have another means of assessing value, and those ratios and the premiums do give you some advantage there. So let me look at each of those real quick. Mm-hmm. With the ratios, you've got the gold-silver ratio, and 60 to 1 up to 100 to 1 serves as the range for silver in a bear market. Acquiring in that ratio range is in anticipation of a shift to a bull market range, which is more like 30 to 1 to 40 to 1 in that range, up to 60, but you'll see it trade into the 30s and 40s. The reason these ratios matter is because you're trying to build ounces organically, using the ratio to generate more, essentially free ounces. So going from silver to gold and back to silver allows for a permanent metals allocation in your total net worth picture, which is compounding ounces. And it addresses one of the major concerns that investors often have, which is, why would I own gold and silver when it doesn't pay me any interest? And in fact, you can compound your ounces if you play the ratios. So what do I mean by compounding ounces? You take existing ounces to generate additional new ounces, net of your capital gains, net of your tax, net of your storage and transaction costs. So what are the extra ounces you have after all of those expenses? Now, obviously, if you're talking about IRA assets, you have some huge advantages in terms of the compounding of ounces, because your biggest hit there is not storage, is not transaction costs.
It's Uncle Sam, yeah.
It's the capital gains tax. So you've got cheap storage, and you've got no capital gains tax while in the retirement account structure. So that's on ratios. Now, the second point is on premiums. There's certain products that sell with a heightened sensitivity to supply and demand, and therefore you see swings in the premiums above the raw metals content.
Well, look at junk bags to 1,000-ounce bars. How many times have you made that work for you, Dave?
Yeah, well, just in the last decade, there's been three instances where that trade has worked very well. That premium is not a constant, and that's the thing to key in on here. The premium is not a constant, and properly played, it allows for additional free ounces. Just like with the gold-silver ratio, the premiums can also play the same way. 90% junk is a great example. 715 ounces of silver in a bag with $1,000 face value. So sometimes it's available on the market at almost no premium, where you're just paying for the silver itself. Sometimes it's available under very high demand scenarios, and those premiums can be as high as 20 or 30% above the silver content. So what we're talking about here is harvesting the premium, liquidating into those high demand environments, and turning around and reinvesting the premium gained into new ounces of silver.
So one of the main points, and we've talked about this many times, is price in dollars is really one of the least important measures of exit strategies.
Right. So there is the proper construction of a metals portfolio, which allows for this. We're talking about silver primarily and the gold-silver ratio, but there's premium plays in the gold side too. And again, proper construction of a portfolio on the front end allows for you to accumulate greater ounces as you go on with the hard asset metals portfolio. So price, as it relates to silver in the question that was listed here by Eli, price as it relates to silver in an exit strategy, to me, it's more than a matter of price. Mm. There are other factors than, say, a $5 or $10 move, which are important to consider. And it's ultimately a move out of the metals altogether is in light of what those tangible assets can be exchanged for. Does that make sense?
Right.
So how do ounces translate into acres?
If you're a farmer, right.
How do ounces translate into square feet if you want to own rental properties? How do ounces translate into shares of publicly traded companies? The point in the question that I like the most is that a one-time liquidation, that's not advisable. So you've got dollar cost averaging into a position in metals, which makes sense, and dollar cost averaging out also makes sense. And you'll see the premiums change, you'll see the ratios change, and you know, we talked about 30 or 40 to 1. In the Hunt Brother days, we did see it get as low as 15 to 1.
Right.
And the difference, if we're looking at the long-term projection for gold and silver, the difference between a 30 to 1 ratio and a 15 to 1 ratio is the difference between $120 silver and $250 silver, or thereabouts. So you do see a radical shift higher in the price on the basis of the gold-silver ratio.
Isn't that why you also don't recommend just going all in or all out at the same time?
That's right.
Increment.
Well, what it assumes is that you have more information than you actually do.
Right.
It assumes that you know exactly what's going to happen in the future, and that's not realistic. So incremental acquisition, incremental reduction. You can use the ratios, you can use the premiums to compound ounces within a permanent metals portfolio. And I think the happiest scenario, this is the happiest scenario for the long-term gold and silver holder. It's when you've reduced your position of ounces by the original dollar amount that you invested.
Mm.
And now you hold...
Everything else is free.
Yeah, you hold the remainder theoretically for free with a zero cost basis. That's another topic altogether, maybe one that we could do even an entire program on, where intergenerational strategies for a zero basis portfolio.
Yeah, Dave, I think I have to just add, after doing this for about 31 years and these strategies, it is a moving target. There's not just a set algorithm that we just use. I mean, you have to look at a lot of different factors. Now, I'm going to move on to Dave's question. Dave says, I have an observation that will turn into a question. When I was a young man, I always wondered why so many people had mortgages, but there couldn't possibly be enough bank deposits to finance the mortgages. He says, now I understand why. Is it easier to understand the subject of economics if we begin with the assumption that we have a fraudulent monetary system?
And I appreciate that completely. What I would say is that banking and credit are essentially ingredients in a political bargain. And whoever is in office, political office, gets to decide not only what banks exist, but how those banks will be rewarded for the issuance of credit. They set the tone in the credit markets. There's inextricably this link between politics and banking. So lending to a particular constituency is the result of banks and politicians figuring out who else they want to benefit. In one administration, that might be corporate fat cats, and another, that might be the lower middle class. You just fill in the blanks. Whoever's in office is going to help influence the direction of credit flow. And they ultimately do that because banks, want to profit. Politicians want to secure power and need money to do that. So they benefit from the process too. And so I guess when you describe the system as fraudulent, you might describe the fiat money system that we have as fraudulent just because there's nothing backing in it. But it's probably more accurate to describe our credit system as politicized and self-interested.
Dave, if I were to think back to the last, there's a lot of presidents who have challenged the Fed and said, you know, I wonder about the Fed. But really, you have to go back to Andrew Jackson to find a president that actually would discredit what you just now said. So what I'm saying is that adds credit to the fact that politics and banking, they play a key hand-in-hand role. Look at Trump right now. Okay, he's talked about auditing the Fed. He's talked about cracking down on some of the banking problems. But in reality, the banks have to be there for him to get done what he needs to get done. So there's a charade that continues to go on. And like the budget deficit, you know, you have to act like you're going to shut the government down until you don't.
Well, credit flows, and that has an impact on the economy. To the degree that the economy is doing better or worse, there is a direct political consequence, and that's why politicians absolutely care about the credit flowing and who it flows to. If they can help direct that flow, they certainly will. Banks want to make money, that's
right.
Clear. They need government support, and they also need government protection. You can see how the banks were protected during the last global financial crisis and how the losses were apportioned to other players, not directly to the banks themselves. So again, you see this link between politics and banking. Politicians typically look for longevity in office, and they're constantly looking for ways to favor their constituencies. So lending and credit availability is one way of doing that. Mm-hmm. More and more people have mortgages. That's an expression of social system design and as a favor from politicians to people. Because essentially, the better off you feel, better lifestyle, new home, even if you couldn't afford it, you may be living beyond your means using someone else's capital for your lifestyle, but it makes you feel good. And gratitude, I think, does get expressed to the crew that, quote unquote, made life better for you.
Moving on to something that really affects our retired folks right now. What potential do you see for a large-scale pension crisis in the coming years?
The crisis is here. I think underfunding is a real-time issue, and it ebbs and flows in terms of the value of stocks and bonds. So it's a bigger crisis or a smaller crisis in light of where financial assets are. But any volatility with current assets, lower stocks or lower bonds or both, and you've now got a real PR problem. It's already set. You already have underfunding in almost every pension out there today. But the underfunding becomes more exaggerated with a decline in the value of the assets. So ultimately, if it's a PR issue, it then becomes a political issue. I assume a pension crisis will be full-blown in the context of the market illiquidity and decline in equities, which we anticipate heading into 2019.
Okay, so, but it's not just equities that these pensions hold. I mean, bonds is really, aren't bonds the bedrock of a pension plan generally?
Generally, that's true. But I think, you know, bonds are likely to see higher rates, which equals lower value. So to the degree that pensions have exposure to bonds, they have some capital losses to take there. And the reality is they have been allocating more and more to favor equities over bonds to get to their expected rates of return of 7, 8, 9%. So I would guess that as they've shifted towards equities, they've got a real beating to take there. And ultimately, as they shift back towards bonds, they may take another beating all over again, losing on bonds again as yields shift higher, prices lower, because I think that's probably a new secular trajectory for interest rates and bonds.
Well, do they have to use the shell game since they're underfunded? I mean, it becomes almost like fractional reserve banking. You just hope that everybody doesn't come for their money at the same time.
And this is the beauty of holding long-term assets to the degree that they have a reprieve on mark-to-market. In the bond world, they may not be penalized as much in terms of underfunding because they can say, look, we bought a $1,000 bond. Currently, it's priced at $600, but we're not intending to sell it. We're holding it to maturity anyway, so don't force us to market to market. And therefore, we won't appear as underfunded, and you won't impinge upon current cash flow for the corporation or the entity that's supporting the pension. Pensions will have to ignore any and all mark-to-market rules, which if they were allowed to be in effect would reveal greater degrees of underfundedness.
But politics will probably play into that as well. I mean, let's face it, if you have a pension crisis, they're going to be screaming at the president, whoever he is.
Yeah, so to the degree that the pension crisis takes on a political tone, companies may get bailed out by the U.S. government. And, you know, there's a variety of ways that that might occur. You might see the government come in like a knight on the white horse offering retirees something like an annuity from the government. So, yeah, again, imagine a world where the Treasury Department, for instance, absorbs the remaining assets of a fund, pension fund, which is underfunded. They take on the assets in exchange for a long-term liability to them to pay out this annuity, and it's tied to U.S. government bonds. They're able to convert those assets to some degree into a captive audience for bonds. That's, again, these are all theoretical possibilities. But a final note, that the greatest risk to a pensioner has always been what a government does to the money, that is the value of the currency that you're denominated in. Even with a guaranteed payment on a pension, like an annuity structure, how does the Treasury manage that liability via the Fed? And there I think you see the classic inflation tax on display. The reason they know they can take on that long-term liability is because they know they can inflate it away.
Well, they'd manage it just like they've managed the deficit. You know, Keynes says that this is a tax, inflation, that is, that only one in a million understand. Okay, but the same person asked the question, do you feel some pensions are safe, or will it likely be systemic and all pension managers will request a bailout? I often think of the city of Stockton, the listener says, when it went bankrupt and many of the workers lost their pensions.
Well, I often think of Citibank, not just the city of Stockton. So, you know, is Citibank, when we went through the global financial crisis, how connected was Citibank? Who takes care of government payroll? I mean, how integrated are they into, you know, sort of the spheres of both public and private life?
Mm.
Pension risk is directly related to how politically important or unimportant the pensioners are seen as being. So I think size matters. I think location matters. I think future political strategy matters. So that question would be, do you matter? That's the question on the table as far as a politician is concerned. Is there a political benefit to the cost incurred from a bailout for a particular pension? And if there's not a benefit, then your pension would be in a high-risk category.
Okay, and staying with pensions, this is the final portion of this question. Could the Fed raising interest rates to double-digit levels be a form of bailout if there was a crisis, ignoring the inflation factors that would also hurt the pensions drawers at the same time?
Well, keep in mind how much debt is in the system today, corporate, private, governmental. With so much leverage in the system, what would be good for the pensions would crush the corporate sector and would make rolling over national debt obligations impossible. So raising interest rates to double-digit levels, a la Paul Volcker, is not possible. It's not possible on a – that's not to say it can't happen driven by market mandate, but it's not possible from the standpoint of policy mandate because you would be forcing bankruptcies.
This next question is directed toward Doug Nolan's tactical short that you and Doug work with, Dave. It says, in the last conference call for the tactical short, it was mentioned there could be a traditional mutual fund coming like the tactical short. Do you have any further information or a timeline on that?
Working on it, negotiating things, nothing on the immediate horizon. I think the current structure is adequate, but we're still exploring the mutual fund option. I would say that's long term. And again, I can only hold my breath for about three and a half minutes. I wouldn't hold your breath much longer than that.
Okay, but you do have an option, I believe, for IRAs that's to a smaller minimum. And it's not a mutual fund, but it does allow a person with a larger IRA that has money, say, in equities that have to be hedged.
That's right.
You do have an option there.
That's right. It's called the tactical non-correlated as opposed to the tactical short. And there's just a few limitations that we have to be cognizant of because you can't have a margin function within a retirement account. So we can accomplish almost the same thing, and our results have been very comparable between the non-correlated and the tactical short.
This is on a similar note, mutual fund note. Is it possible to create a traditional mutual fund that works the strategy of changing percentages in metals held, you know, the ratios of gold to silver and others, as you often discuss?
Well, it had been done. Now, I guess what I'm thinking of is one that had a mix of the metals. It was not a dynamic fund trading between them, but it did have a mix between them, a combination gold and silver. Because the fund structure was a closed-end fund structure, that fund would periodically trade with premiums or discounts. So nothing exists today that dynamically trades the ratio. We have a huge number of clients that trade the ratios at our direction, and I think their hesitation in the form of a mutual fund would be moving from direct ownership in the physical metals to indirect ownership of metals via a basket that holds the metals. So now you're just an owner in the basket, shares in a basket, with the underlying asset being the metals themselves. A lot of our clients generally eschew counterparties wherever and whenever possible. So I'm sure there's a market for it, but I know our clients are much more sensitive to just owning the physical metals and looking for us to advise them on the ratio trades.
Well, and just to repeat, on the compound ounces trades, I think a good advisor who's done it for decades is better than a simple mutual fund algorithm that does it for everybody. In a way, that cancels out some of the effectiveness of it because these things have to be customized. This next question moves to surveillance. It's from Vietnam, and I was fascinated when I read it. It says, your interview with Dr. Gandhi, okay, and of course that was the author of The Panoptic Sort. He says, it brings some things to mind for me living in Vietnam. Vietnam is not China, but there are some elements of similarity that I see in your discussion concerning China. One of those is the cultural desire for control. By the way, that's not just China, but it is cultural. Those private businesses in Vietnam use cameras and microphones and place them in many places, as many places actually as they can. As an example, the gym I go to has 9 cameras placed strategically throughout the fairly small facility. Boy, I'd have to suck my gut in, Dave, if that was the case. If you had the wherewithal, you could actually hack the system and watch my whole workout. Same with my apartment building. Not only does the garage have 4 cameras with microphones, each landing has another camera positioned on the tenants' doors. Why is that? To put it simply, the Vietnamese, as well as the Chinese, they have very similar cultures in certain regards, and Vietnam was essentially an extension of China for over 1,000 years before the French showed up. They have a great deal of insecurity and distrust concerning their stuff and what they have. When I lived in Colombia, I saw a similar amount of cameras everywhere. In Colombia, it was driven by just as much distrust as the poor people stealing their stuff. I'm not much of an investor, but I see, unfortunately, that there's an incredible investment opportunity in companies involved in security cameras throughout the third world. Dave, when I read this question, I went and looked online to see the returns on security camera companies. And actually, 2017, not 2018, but 2017 was a very good year for security cameras. But when we talked about this last night, we actually launched more into an ethics discussion than we did a make money discussion. So I'd like you to address a couple of things. One is the panoptic sort, you know, this encroachment on liberty, the surveillance. There's a difference. If you have cameras up to defend yourself, there's a difference between defending yourself and your home and your business than surveilling people for control, is there not?
Yeah, and I think this is where, to some degree, political philosophy would represent something of a restraint for me in certain investment opportunities. Just because it's an opportunity doesn't mean that I'm necessarily going to feel compelled to take advantage of it, because I may feel uncomfortable for, to one degree or another. Describing Vietnam and insecurity and distrust, that I understand. That is sort of in defense of liberty and in defense of personal protection. That makes sense to me as a motive to have security cameras. But if you move to a more developed use or abuse of them, whether it's in China or very acutely, you know, 1 million, 2 million cameras, I don't know how many millions of cameras they have now in the UK, you're talking about data collection, you're talking about people control, you're talking about a dynamic which to me is surveillance versus defense. Mm-hmm. And it's really tough for me to see that as, you know, some people might object on moral grounds to, you know, investing in a tobacco company. Whether that's you or not, it doesn't matter. I say I have a political, philosophical issue if it's a company that's profiting on developing a surveillance state. That is really uncomfortable for me. It's like partnering for personal gain with Big Brother. And I, there's something that instinctively I say, I don't know if I can do that. totally understand the insecurity, the distrust, and wanting, you know, defense and personal protection. That makes sense to me.
Next question. Hi from Down Under. Thanks for a great commentary. You've inspired me to financially educate myself. Learning about the printing of money and fractional lending, what a shock to the system. My question is, how should I invest or diversify the $700,000 Australian dollar proceeds that I have from a sale in Sydney on an investment property? Keep in mind, I have one or two more properties owned outright. I have 13 kilos of gold bullion in a deposit box outside of the banks and a few other bits and pieces. I have a limited knowledge on investing above what I have learned recently. Thanks again and the best with all your endeavors. Kind regards, Pete. Okay, so Dave, gold, he's got some proceeds, $700,000 in Australian dollars, a couple of properties. What would you suggest?
Well, a part of this is an issue of real estate and real estate exposure in Australia at this point. Looks as if the property market in Australia is going to come under more pressure. And, you know, if the remaining two properties are of high value as well, perhaps one thing to consider is selling one of the two remaining properties and reducing the real estate exposure. Equity can disappear pretty quickly. Reduce your total real estate exposure. That would kind of be my takeaway. Personal investment properties, you know, what's a healthy target? 25% of net worth. That would be kind of an optimal goal. And you'll find that in the U.S., that is usually more like 75% because people focus a lot on having a bigger and bigger house. And as they have a bigger and bigger house and then end up paying it off, it does represent a larger piece of their total net worth. But I view 25% as the real goal in terms of property investment and personal use. The kilo bars make sense. I think cash makes sense. I would diversify your cash between U.S. dollars, Australian dollars, perhaps additional kilo bars. I think the vaulted program, it's designed to provide same as cash liquidity and maybe even short-term government bonds, Australian bonds, U.S. government bonds, New Zealand government bonds.
You would say cash and gold for right now and then move back into real estate?
Well, the emphasis on cash and gold in a moderated position in real estate is not because of a dislike for real estate,
right,
or a dislike for stocks and bonds, but you're talking about really overvalued assets given what central bankers around the world have been trying to do, pumping up those asset prices. So I think the really impactful piece here is that if you have a significant slowdown in China, and this is apropos to the Australian property market, the slowdown in China would have a huge impact on Australia.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, prioritizing liquidity is so that you're in a position to own all of the aforementioned assets, whether it's on the Aussie Stock Exchange or more of all of those assets. But I think what you're really looking at is Chinese financial market fragility, which would have a massive impact on the overinflated assets there in Australia. So position yourself accordingly, higher liquidity, vary the forms of liquidity, balance it between paper liquidity, dollars, Australian dollars, New Zealand dollars, and your kilo bar theme, and maybe look at vaulted.com as a cash alternative. That's really what it was designed for.
So, Dave, it goes back to your exit strategy mentality, okay, and your compounding strategy. There's compounding ounces if you're staying in the metals, compounding acres if you're going into land, compounding cash. There are times when you're actually compounding cash. Okay, moving on to the next question. Back to a surveillance question, Dave. The listener asks, Edward Snowden reveals that all American telephone calls are collected and stored along with text messages and email messages. What do Americans do? He says, well, they continue to use telephone and emails when they should be using alternative methods of communication that are now available. Here's his question. Why do businesses in America continue to use the telephone and email to communicate, including McIlvaney? Please answer with a conversation on this topic.
Well, and I think it's worthy of a conversation. Really, we're talking about ease of communication. We're talking about business structures which are built around those technologies. And we know that if it travels over the internet, it's not private. There are workarounds for that, you know, the dark web or dark net. And there will come a point when weighing the costs of transitioning to new business structure and new venues for communication, weigh those against the benefits, and I think an exit might occur. You know, this goes back to the old book, and I highly recommend it, Exit, Voice, and Loyalty, in which the author looks at either you have the opportunity to voice opposition to policies and things that you don't like, you're locked into a loyalty structure where you're just not going to change, or you simply get out. And you're asking a good question. The question is, why have we not exited? And, you know, I don't think the position that we're taking now will always be the case, the position that we're taking. Perhaps being able to analyze some of these topics has taken away some of the urgency to shift exposure. But again, I don't think that will always be the case. An exit is always a possibility.
One of the things you've tried to incorporate in this show, Dave, is an awareness of the dangers. It's not just Ed Snowden that has been bringing this out, but we've had a number of guests that have helped to show where the vulnerability is. And quite honestly, most of my email, it doesn't matter that it's collected, okay? But the emails that it does matter, I'm not going to use email, or I'll use some other form of communication. So you have to use a certain amount of judgment. You can't completely exit the system and still be able to participate in the system.
But it's important to know where necessary encryption is an option, and it's an option we'll use. So there are some things that we do already implement.
This next question brings up a term that maybe not all of our listeners are aware of, but the term debt jubilee. And I think that references back to the Bible in the book of Leviticus, when every 50 years debt was either forgiven or given back to the original owner. It was a way of cleansing the system. So here's the question. Dear all, please could you provide the possible scenarios on how a debt jubilee would play out and what the impact would be on precious metals prices? I mean, is that even a possibility where debt is just relieved?
It seems to me a jubilee, the forgiveness of debt, would have to be focused in such a way that only one particular creditor takes a hit. And there's only one particular creditor that I think could take the hit, and that's the government. So if the government was able to cordon off the asset in question, prevent insolvencies from, in sort of a daisy chain effect, into the private sector, into the private markets, then it could be considered. The only debt of that kind that comes to mind in the U.S. is student loans. Out of the 44 million Americans that owe debt on the student loans, 42.3 of those owe it to the government. Right. So again, you're talking about sort of this cordoned off space. 1.3 out of the 1.5 trillion, it's a government asset. So they could write it down, they could write it off, and you have far fewer credit market consequences than other areas within the credit markets. If you start, you know, again, announcing a jubilee or whatever, cancellation of debts, you know, to every creditor, that debt is an asset, and you're wiping out the asset, wiping out the solvency. There's ramifications into the financial markets. And of course, we've got lots and lots of those quote unquote assets floating out there today. So again, the first criteria is, I think, government held, not private credit. That's the first criteria. The second criteria is that it must have a political benefit. There's going to be a cost. And so maybe they say, well, we can take it. What or who does the benefit accrue to? So we go back to that list, you know, 42.3 million people who owe debt to the government, 44 million total that have student loans. That's 44 million voters who would agree that it's a good idea.
Right. Goes back to politics, like you were talking with banking.
Exactly. So maybe that's enough in terms of a people who would show up or shift their votes because of the favor done to swing an election. So, you know, for perspective, the student loan balance, the 1.5 trillion total, it's about 500 billion more than all outstanding credit card debts. And as it affects the metals market, again, I think there's limited impact into the metals market because there's only a limited space where you could cancel the debt without there being massive ramifications into a broader financial universe.
Aren't they already canceling the debt by printing money? I mean, it still goes back in a way. It's that inflation thing that we talked about before. You can come out and just announce a canceled debt, or you can just inflate it away. Next question. David, you've sent me down a historical, philosophical, economic yellow brick road rabbit hole with your book recommendations. And I thank you for it. Now, here is your must read. I am a loyal listener. So here's my question. Since the dollar and the SWIFT system is what we have right now, they will most likely lose hegemony in our lifetime. You and I both agree that it will hit the fan. But when it does, the dollar might still strengthen against all other currencies. Don't you think it would be a better entry point for precious metals after the next down leg of 150-ish?
Interesting question. Thanks for the the acknowledgement on the rabbit holes. There are many rabbit holes to go down when you're living your life vicariously through bibliographies. The gold market can rise and fall, reflecting currency strength or weakness. So the first point that the questioner makes, that's true. So the gold market can rise and fall, reflecting currency strength or weakness. There is demand for the precious metal as a safe haven or investment demand, which also can drive the price. And that is regardless of the currency moves. In fact, it can outstrip any currency move. So a strengthening dollar does not necessarily mean gold will go down. And a declining dollar does not necessarily mean that gold will go up. And we could give you some historical examples of that. When the dollar went through its initial decline in the early 70s, it finally stabilized, moved sideways, and actually started to inch up, even as gold was moving from $300 to $400 to $600 to $800. It was not in a period of a declining dollar. So just be wary of that idea that either strength or weakness in the dollar, you know, there's an axiomatic move in the price of gold on the other side of that. I think the more uncertainty we see in the global monetary system, back to this idea of losing hegemony and the SWIFT system being redone or undone, if you have a disruption of the status quo, you by default are going to have a larger audience for gold investment. And metals may move lower. Yeah, okay, you could have spot prices, you know, tied to the futures contracts, you could have them move lower. But here's my final point, is that investment demand being on the rise in this kind of an environment, pricing of the asset can go lower because of what happens in the futures pit. But be aware that pricing in the physicals market can be well above the spot price, and that reflects a premium for available physical metal versus the paper position in the commodities pits. The scenario that you're describing in the question, it's a scenario that's a very good theoretical one for seeing. Let's just take your example, gold trading lower, but because of the chaos, the disruption to the status quo, real buyers of real metals coming into the metals market and the physical metals market being strained, where the premiums are such that it doesn't matter. Price goes down, you can't buy it any cheaper in the physical market if you want to take physical delivery.
That's exactly what we saw in 2008. That's exactly what we saw. We could see it even worse this next time around. Now, 3 weeks ago, Christine Lagarde said, you know, I think central banks ought to start issuing digital currency. So this is what this question refers to. What do you see and think about the message that Christine Lagarde put out to all nations about switching to a digital currency, and for our country, is she dropping a hint of major changes coming for the world, and will we be a total digital currency world?
Well, I don't know if we'll be a total digital currency world, but I think she is dropping hints, so I think I'd answer that with a yes. It reminds me of the goals of many of the financial elites, and that is how to extract rents from every living being on the planet. Very similar, if you remember our conversations throughout this last year or so, with the idea of quote-unquote financial inclusion, the idea that India is pushing as they bring everyone into the banking system. And of course, it's for their own good. But the justification, the advertising for it, the scaremongering that accompanies it is you've got to eliminate the black market. You've got to eliminate all these evil things that happen with the use of physical cash. The reality is that digital currencies leave a better breadcrumb trail for the activity of the user. And if you're managing a system, trying to extract rents, increase taxes, et cetera, you want those breadcrumb trails. And so today, if you look at the digital currency universe, you may say, well, gosh, every user is anonymous. And that's arguable. But I don't believe anyone will remain anonymous, even if that can be accomplished today. If a government wants to spend the resources to track an IP address, they're going to get it done. And so whatever can be hidden, I would argue, you know, for those who feel like there's security in the digital currency world today, whatever can be hidden, whatever provides anonymity today can also be discovered. And I think it's that's just a question of time and materials.
This goes back to the security camera question from Vietnam. I mean, it's about control. And digital currency, going digital, is not just for convenience, it's control.
Right. And I think there's historical precedent. If you want to go back to Babel, this is really about the idea of building a better mousetrap, of creating a system and a structure which is so efficient and so beautiful that it cannot be matched, and you can't begin to measure the success of it.
Your 12-year-old son, the other day, they were in for your birthday, and we were talking, and he's been reading utopian literature, and he corrected himself. He said, it's always dystopian. Utopia always moves to dystopia. And I thought, gosh, I wish I could think like that when I was 12.
Well, so for Lagarde, for her to champion the digital currencies, it's not a vote purely for technological advancement in the monetary realm. I don't believe that for a minute. Ask this. Like with the question on debt jubilee, is there a winner? Is there a loser? What are the political costs? What are the political benefits? And so I think in this particular time slice, the benefits of digital currencies are broadly privacy related to the digital currency user. That is, I believe, a temporary benefit limited to this particular time slice. The ultimate benefit goes to those that can see the flow of supply and demand and extract value from the flow. So governments will co-opt the tech if it competes directly with them. This goes back to Ken Rogoff, the conversation that we had earlier this year, Kevin, and the quote that we shared from his Project Syndicate article. The long history of currency, Ken Rogoff says, tells us that what the private sector innovates, the state eventually regulates and appropriates. In this case, the governing elite are beginning to see the value of tracking every transaction and eliminating any opt-out mechanism. So I think over the past 2 years, the use of cash, if you've been to Europe in the last 2 years, just understand that operating a business there is changing. It's changing. Cash is scrutinized. Banks ask questions about every cash deposit, every withdrawal. There is not enough data related to cash, and digital provides data, system-wide corralling, and ultimately, I think digital provides control. So I'd love to talk this over with Ms. Lagarde, because perhaps her intentions are different, but how the financial system, how the political system above and beyond just Christine Lagarde treats this, again, I think it's how the political system would use such a move, in my mind, in the final analysis, which would be dystopian.
Maybe we should put her on the McElvaney Weekly Commentary guest list and make a call over there. I think you'd enjoy that conversation.
I'll see if she says yes.
Next question. Hi, David and Kevin. Love your weekly commentary. Haven't missed an episode since I started tuning in 4 years ago. Well, thank you. Thanks very much. That's awesome. I have a question for you regarding real estate. I'm sure, just like many of your listeners, the majority of my wealth consists in the equity that I have accumulated in my home. How do we best protect that equity in the coming recession? Many experts are talking about a global bubble in real estate. And where I live, in Vancouver, Canada, the bubble seems to be even bigger than the global average. If you could please give us your opinion on the best strategy to protect the equity in our homes, I'm sure that many of the listeners would appreciate it. Thanks, Tristan.
Well, frankly, without selling it, it's not possible. And so maybe the question is this the time to own? Is this the time to rent? Or is this the time to get philosophical about the loss of equity? Because you can say, look, I'm just not willing to create a move like that, a disruptive move for
you
my family.
You may love the house.
Right.
May love living on the lake.
In which case, you better get philosophical
right.
about watching the value of your home ebb and flow. So there is a possible solution, which is to create something like a sinking fund for debt against your property. And I don't know I think this applies if you have no debt against your property. You just think of it theoretically as more of a hedge. But I did this back in 2009, using the sinking fund concept. During the last global financial crisis, you had Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They were right in the middle of the chaos. You had home lending. There was a huge part of the credit excess in that period. Home prices declined by 30 to 50% here in the United States, and certainly the rest of the world saw its fair share of losses as well. Perhaps this go round, the declines are more modest because it's not specifically a mortgage-backed securities bubble. It's a bubble in everything.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe, just for the sake of argument, maybe the declines are more modest. Gold was up $1,000 an ounce through that time frame, 2009 to 2012. And I chose the sinking fund concept in 2009. That was the year we bought our house.
That's good timing.
So ounces, again, bottom at 900, they move up $1,000. Put them in kilo bars. Again, vaulted programs ideal for that kind of thing. It's a cash equivalent. It has a specific use and function. It's going to be used for something else. You use those ounces as an offset to dollars in debt. And over the last 9 years, basically, I've discounted the debt using current gold values here at 1250. I've discounted that debt by 38%. Okay, so that's a strategy that has worked for me thus far. Now, if I had really been on it, I would have liquidated the bars at a $1,900 gold price and paid the house off.
Right. Who would have known?
Hindsight's 2020, yeah. Right? Hindsight's 20. I'd have the house debt-free playing that little market arbitrage. But the downside in real estate and the potential decline in equity could, to a degree, be offset in a bullion gold position. I really don't think about the white metals here because they're too volatile,
right,
for that sinking fund concept. But I go back to my first answer. Without selling, it's not possible to lock in your equity. You may be able to create an offset that requires some liquidity to do that. And what I chose is dollar for dollar allocating to gold set right next to my debt. So essentially, I was debt-free on the property, and I've just played the bank over that percentage and have discounted the debt by 38%. Ultimately, I think I'll discount that debt by 75% or more, and I won't be quite so slow to act next time, exiting the kilo bar position and paying off the note.
Dave, this next question is asked by a thinking millennial trying to figure out his student loan at this point. Student loans, the question starts, are owed by Americans, and they now total $1.5 trillion. The amount of interest paid on these loans hinder the millennial generation and inhibit the affordability of first-time home buyers. Boy, are we seeing that. I have heard some financial experts say that there's a possibility that student loans would be forgiven. This is that debt jubilee. It's a form of that debt jubilee, Dave, in order to stimulate the economy after an economic downturn. I'm a millennial in that same boat, paying back student loans each month. I'm considering taking most of my current savings and applying it to the loan that has an interest rate of 6.55%. I figure paying down debt, accumulating at 6.55 APR, would be more effective than keeping in a 2% savings account. The only two shortfalls I foresee are, one, student loans would be forgiven in the future, or two, the opportunity cost of applying savings toward my principal is greater than that 6.55%. What are your thoughts on student loan debt and its forgiveness during tough financial times? And also your thoughts on a future opportunity cost on cash savings once equities reach a favorable PE ratio?
Great question. And obviously part of that we covered a little bit with our comments on student loans and debt jubilee earlier. So similar to the jubilee question, let me skip over that part as answered previously and focus on part two, the opportunity cost. Well, okay, one thing on debt forgiveness. It's a huge potential political scheme, mm-hmm, right? And the probabilities seem to be higher from now until 2022. So you look at the current populist trends globally and in the United States, you've got the rise of non-establishment political coalitions, non-establishment parties, potential for third parties, or new versions, you know, Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump. These are expressions of something happening within our society. I think whoever offers it up, this idea of debt forgiveness, whoever offers it up, whether it's Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump or someone somewhere else on the political spectrum, you know, like Trump capturing a larger part of the labor vote in 2016, it could be a defining political present, a political gift that's given to that constituency. And again, as I mentioned earlier, a swing in election thereby. Opportunity cost. Think of it in time frames. So over a 1 year time frame, there's not much opportunity cost. In fact, 6.55% is the winner. If it's a short time frame, pay it off. You're not judging the future. You're judging more of the short-term present. I feel a little bit differently if you're talking about a 3 to 5 year period. I would have a preference for metals. I would watch not just the price of the metals, but I would watch the Dow gold ratio. Long term, the Dow to gold ratio of 5 to 1 or 4 to 1 or 3 to 1 on the ratio, this would be very, very intriguing. Begin shifting towards equities with a lower price earnings multiple in mind, as you noted in your question. But in the process, what you'd be doing is you'd be utilizing the Dow Gold Ratio, and there's the possibility of expanding your financial footprint 4x, four times, before buying stocks at a nominal discount. So again, you take the Dow and divide it by the price of gold. Today, it's right around 20 to 1. We began this journey in the year 2000 at a 43 to 1 ratio. And in the fullness of time, with a low PE ratio, that is low price stocks relative to earnings and gold at higher prices, you're looking at sort of the perfect exchange, 5 to 1, 4 to 1, 3 to 1. May see lower numbers, but for your purposes, from a 20 to 1 where we are today on the ratio to a 4 to 1 or a 5 to 1, you're talking about a 4x increase in purchasing power and getting what you wanted in terms of cheap stocks when the PEs are revealing that.
Again, so many questions can be answered in a different way than just how much money can you make and when do we make money. It's what are you trading it into? What's your exit strategy? What's your goal? Is your goal more ounces of gold? Is it, like we talked before, is it acreage? Is it stocks?
Well, part of the reason that is because we look at the value of the dollar with a certain critical eye.
With skepticism.
There is a goal to deflate the value of our currency, to take away its purchasing power
by 2% a year. It's a stated goal. 2% a year is the stated goal.
It's a stated goal. So yeah. When I look at the dollar, I don't look at it as a long-term store of value. I see it as a short-term liquidity vehicle, not a long-term store of value.
You know what it reminds me of? Remember the video game Frogger? You would hop onto different floating lily pads to get across. The dollar
acceptable.
Is one of those lily pads.
Perfectly acceptable.
Yeah.
Just don't stay too long or you'll lose the game.
That's right. Well, Dave, where did the time go? I mean, we're only halfway through these questions, so next week we'll have to pick up on this.
And probably pick up our pace.
I got to admit, I love the question coming up in the beginning of next week's program. So
yes.
I'm just baiting people right now, but
yeah,
I think everyone needs to hear the answer to this question as well as the question.
From a fellow philosophy grad studying the markets, and sometimes when you're reading charts, you're not wearing a pinstripe suit.
Stay tuned next week so that you can hear why Dave said that. You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, our question and answers program, number one. Listen to number two next week. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.